chat. Keep it alive through these lines I write. I keep it live cause I thrive. I might just blow your mind tonight. I'm so hyped, but it's no hype. From this height, it's direct hits on sight. I'm your type, lend me your ears to show you that there's something in me. I'm not giving up, I'm standing right here, holding these days hostage, and I'll make this my year. We turning fear into love, and the love's in the air. I love doing this cause nothing compares, nothing can share that same type of feeling. When you feeling them flares, they can't catch it, it's havoc. I rip to a tear, switch the scenario, my stereos, I leave them impaired. Variables start to change, and they're all in my range. I just gotta grab it, it's all mathematics. Every step is drastic, I make it fantastic. I'm trying to take your breath away, asthmatic.
This is live through the stereo. Go and let it blow, blow through the stereo. I'ma let them know, no through the stereo. Yo, here we go, go through the stereo, stereo. This is live through the stereo. Go and let it blow, blow through the stereo. I'ma let them know, no through the stereo. Yo, here we go, go through the stereo, stereo.
Yeah, just nod your head with it. So explicit and vivid. Every image is intricate, intimate. I put my all into it. No scrimmage and no rules. I'm a pro tool. Hear my heartbeat beat into the vocals. I'm so loco, lost my mind, oh no. It's ponderoso, dope so. No overdose, cause it's dope, yo. Man, this is house grown, mixed with some milestones. So I let the style flow, down like the Dow Jones. Bringing it with some foul tones, letting the crowd know. We getting loud, so it's eardrum rudiments. Yeah, we bring it rude again, move little hooligan. Music for tuning in, full time to the 10. I'm on my clock like I told you, I'm doing this for dreams we pursuing.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Anti-Media Radio Show once again with your host Nick Burnaby here on UCY.TV and the antimedia.org/radio. Really happy to be back alive and well on this Monday, January 15th, halfway through the month, 2018. What a crazy, insane year it's been so far, right? People are fucking eating Tide Pods. I don't know, is that the flat earth diet or something? The ridiculousness of the public doesn't cease to amaze. I guess if you got nothing better to do and, you know, you want to seeking nothing more than gaining attention on social media, I guess eating dishwasher detergent is a good idea to you. Unfortunately, there actually are a lot of things going on, and there are a lot of things that need to be talked about, and you know, just sitting around trying to get YouTube clicks by eating soap is not really the most productive way to deal with this major situation that we have, that we're dealing with here in the U.S. and around the world. And we're going to talk about some stuff tonight, some impactful things going on around the world. We're going to focus on China. But first, I mean, what else do we have going on? Martin Luther King Day today, a holiday worth celebrating. Martin Luther King, a radical, a person who, when he was alive, was considered basically a terrorist, a communist, a deplorable, a radical. You know, the people nowadays that talk all this smack about Black Lives Matter and protesters and how we should run people over that are blocking the roads. Those are the same kind of people who now say, oh, Martin Luther King, why can't you guys be more like Martin Luther King? He was nonviolent and he never blocked streets and stuff. those same people who pretend like they like Martin Luther King are the same people who call Black Lives Matter nowadays terrorists and thugs, and they should be run over in the street. And if you were to go back in time and place those same people who pretend like they like Martin Luther King, they'd be saying the same kind of garbage that they say right now about Black Lives Matter and other protesters about Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement. You know, know, a bunch of communists, a bunch of terrorists, a bunch of bad people who need to be run over if they block streets. I mean, you go look at the marches. You tell me they didn't block streets. And of course, the government, directly or indirectly, responsible for the death of Martin Luther King. And now the government wants to go and make it a federal holiday. And Donald Trump, the biggest asshole in the country, is out acting like he's celebrating Martin Luther King Day. And here, locally in San Diego, the fucking FBI marches along with all these liberals in the fucking street supposedly supporting Martin Luther King. The FBI, the people who not only, you know, responsible for blackmailing and manipulating and trying to destroy the reputation of Martin Luther King, who possibly also had a hand in killing him, are marching in the street acting like they support the guy. So, I mean, this alternate reality where these politicians are like, oh yeah, Martin Luther King, and the liberals and the Republicans and the conservatives and everybody acting like, oh yeah, it's so nice. And even the like I said, the shit talkers, the fucking assholes online that think protesters should be run over in the street, acting like, oh, Martin Luther King was like so peaceful and he would never have done what these thugs do nowadays. Yeah, sorry. You don't have the full story, because Martin Luther King was very radical. And sure, he mostly used nonviolent tactics, but the stuff they did, I mean, let's put it this way. If Colin Kaepernick offends you, if he melts, if he causes your snowflake to melt, then Martin Luther King would have really done it for you. And so a bunch of hypocrites out here act like they support Martin Luther King. They don't. And if he were around today, they'd hate him, and they'd talk shit about him, and they'd call him a traitor. All the more reason why we do need to support Martin Luther King and remember what he built and what he did, all the work that he accomplished. Because it was a great movement. It was a great movement. And when he started to transcend identity politics and started bringing the poor people, the working class, together in common cause against the Vietnam War and against poverty, well, it was only a matter of time before he was dead. Let's put it that way. I think the government will kind of leave you alone as long as you're just doing identity politics stuff, because they're like, okay, well, you know, as long as it's identity politics, there's going to be reactionaries on the other side that will neutralize the movement. And once you transcend that, you start to become very effective at uniting classes, working classes, together, and that's where the government finds uncertainty and you know, insecurity, basically. And you know, that's why identity politics is really pushed forth from both sides of the political spectrum, be it the alt-right or the, you know, politically correct left. You know, identity politics is allowed to thrive on those ends of the spectrum exactly because it doesn't really accomplish anything politically. In fact, it actually is, you know, counterproductive, I guess, because you lose a lot of the most radical and most energized activists to these identity politics movements. And they neutralize themselves, and then there's just reactionaries that oppose them, and then it's a self-defeating kind of, you know, it's a self-defeating prophecy, I guess you could say. But yeah, I mean, it's huge to get the more accurate version of events, and what happened with the civil rights movement and the treatment of Black people in the U.S., especially in the South, but all over, and how it continues to this day. The structural, systemic racism that continues to this day has not been fixed. There have been improvements since the days of Martin Luther King. I've been down to the Civil Rights Institute down in Birmingham, Alabama, and I was barely able to walk through that thing, because it was so bad. kids being chewed up by police dogs, hundreds of bombings against black establishments, including churches, brutal beatings, lynchings, you know, bunch of really nasty, horrible things that people went through. And now you've got kind of the legalized version of it. Well, you know, back then it was legal, but now it's kind of a kind of swept under the rug version of racism for the liberals and for the, you know, the people that live out in the suburban areas that don't really get to see this kind of stuff. But you've got massive inequality for non-white people. Much fewer opportunities. People just, you know, the racism is still there. People see you walking down the street and you don't look right. You don't look white. Just simply, people look at you strangely if you're in a certain neighborhood or whatever. That's all still there. That's all still there. If you're black and you go apply for a job, you got less chance of getting called back just because. Just because. And people like to say, oh, well, you know, the civil rights movement, the civil rights laws, you know, racism ended in the, you know, once those laws were passed and we've had a black president, so racism doesn't exist anymore. Bull fucking shit. If you're anyone that says that, you're fucking clueless. I'm sorry to say it, but you're an idiot. Racism is more apparent now than it's ever been in the United States, and it's just, it's really not getting much better. I think the conversation being had is a good thing. I think, of course, people get uncomfortable, and people who are, you know, oh, I'm not racist, I'm colorblind and all that. It's uncomfortable for people. But that's what, you know, uncomfortable conversations need to be had, because if you just remain in your comfort zone, well, you're never going to hear out the other side. And so sometimes you got to get a little bit offended and a little bit shaken up and like, oh, shit, yeah, maybe I do some of that stuff. Maybe I could, you know, try to understand what's going on a little bit better, because it's not, you know, it's not over just because you don't realize it. If you live in a damn suburb, you may not even notice it or realize it, but 1,000 people a year being killed by cops. And again, it's not just a race thing. Black people, Native American people are killed at a much higher per capita rate than other people by the cops. But it's not only a black, you know, it's not just black people getting killed. Overwhelmingly, I'll tell you what it is. It's poor people, the poor, the working class getting killed because the police, the laws and all that, just the quote unquote justice system is built to serve the rich, and it keeps us poor folks poor. It holds us down with petty bullshit laws and citations and drug laws and just administrative nanny state bullshit, protecting you from yourself while at the same time keeping people incarcerated and pulling the money away from the working class and giving it to their buddies, the politicians and their buddies. The whole thing, it's backwards. And Martin Luther King Day is a good day to, you know, it's a good day to talk about this stuff, because if it's not talked about, like I said, if the conversation's being had by the fucking liberals walking down the street with the FBI in the parade for Martin Luther King, obviously the conversation isn't being had. Obviously. And you know what? The damn Democrats in the House, now this has still got to go through the Senate, probably going to pass. I mean, passed before, probably going to pass. The FISA thing, which allows for, basically hands Trump a fuckload of authority to go surveil people, American citizens included. The liberals voted for it in the House. They didn't do anything. They didn't, and I'm not even playing you. Some of those same people have been saying, oh, Trump is literally an authoritarian loose cannon. We can't trust him. He can't be trusted. We maybe even need to impeach him. And these dudes go and vote to give the fool more power. I'm not even shitting you. I wish I was joking about this, but, you know, we all know it. Both parties are fucking full of shit. And these liberals want to walk around like they've got the mantle of the civil rights movement. And you know who's fighting for civil rights? I don't agree with the whole running for office thing, but Chelsea Manning is a person who fights for civil rights. And what is happening now? Just, she's being criticized by the conservatives, called a traitor, being criticized by the liberals, being called too radical, being criticized by the libertarians who say, oh, well, she's a man, you know, she can't choose her own gender. Okay, that's super libertarian of you. That person fights for rights, and where is that person being talked shit to, being put down, and on the same breath, these fools are like, Happy Martin Luther King Day, everybody. Yeah, we're carrying on the legacy of Martin Luther King. And by the way, fuck Chelsea Manning. Oh, okay. Yeah, that totally makes a lot of sense. But, you know, surprise, surprise, a bunch of hypocrites in the government. I mean, are we really going to be acting like we're surprised at this point? No. All we can do is really point out, okay, these assholes are at it again. They're doing what they do. Being assholes. And the people who speak the truth are the enemy, and the people who bullshit you and steal your money are the heroes, right? That's what we're supposed to believe. That's what they like to tell us. What else? Oh, this thing in Hawaii, what the hell going on? What the hell went on with that? An alert goes out saying that basically everyone's going to die in Hawaii. I mean, this thing is like, what in the world happened there? Like, it's like, what are you supposed to do? I mean, what would you do if you're sitting there at home and it's like, you get a text message on your phone and it's like, you're about to die right now. Take shelter. This is not a drill. Like, what do you do? I know, you know, here in San Diego, the only likely time that would actually happen is if we had like a tsunami. And then I know, you know, I already have a plan in place where it's like, oh shit, there's a tsunami. Run downstairs, get in the fucking car, and get your ass to higher ground. Okay, but, you know, in Hawaii, you're on this little island, and it's like, oh, you got a missile coming inbound. What in the world are you supposed to do? Plenty of theories to go around on this thing. At face value, they said it was just an accident. Who knows if that's true. The other thing is something DB raised when he was here is that maybe that there was a missile that was shot down. I don't think that's the case. But you never know. Maybe they were doing it to see how people reacted. Or maybe they're just fear-mongering. Maybe they're just trying to raise the threat of North Korea some more, which as if it hasn't been bad enough. Anyway, joining me now, I've got Jim Carrey joining us from geopoliticsalert.com. Not Jim Carrey the actor, Jim Carrey the author. Jim, how you doing, man?
Good. How's it going, dude? How you been?
Not too bad, dude. Haven't talked to you in a while. I remember you came out and visited me here in San Diego one time with Claire a long time ago.
Yeah, what, like 2 years now or something like that?
Yeah, at the time we were like hot on the trail of Nestle. I remember that. That was
a
good time.
Now they're working here. They're doing the same thing here they were doing out by you, which is that, they're trying to bottle up water here. Which, you know, is like the one thing we have with the lakes.
It's so ridiculous because there's so much water right there, and then at the same time, you guys are over like near Detroit, right?
Yeah.
of course you got the whole thing going on with Flint where, you know, these guys can barely even get water that's drinkable, and you're sitting right next to the biggest, you know, fresh body of water in the world, right?
I mean, Flint pumped in from a freshwater river. It was just everything was so polluted, and the chemicals were wrong, and they blew it. They didn't know what they were doing, and they did it to allegedly save money, and then you found out that they weren't actually going to save any money because Detroit was going to give them a discount on water. So,
bunch of fuckery.
Yeah, that was like criminal negligence, really.
Yeah. Hopefully, they'll get some fucking punishment.
Well, there's a country that's lifting people out of poverty. We can talk about that.
Yeah, so that's what we're going to talk about tonight. Jim is a expert on foreign policy stuff, and you've been doing a lot of coverage of China as well as us, and it seems like the world is definitely shifting. The world's balance is shifting in that direction, and we've been talking about it on the show kind of relentlessly because this is really a narrative that isn't being talked about by the mainstream. It's kind of this, oh, Russia thing, and Russia did this, and Russia did that, and Trump is just so stupid, and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
But in the end, it's, and I said this in our last show, it's like, well, you know, China is actually the one who happens to be benefiting from every time Trump fucks up. And I know Russia got the blame for it, but it definitely seems like Trump is more of a Manchurian candidate. First, I want to get your thoughts before we go in on China. I want to get your thoughts on this this missile alert in Hawaii. Do you think this has something to do with North Korea fear mongering, or what do you think that was?
I tend to genuinely believe it was an accident. I mean, obviously, they're testing these systems a lot more now. I'm willing to believe it was an accident because I'm fully aware of how incompetent they are. You know what I mean? Not only that, you're mixing government alerts with Silicon Valley technology, which doubles up on the incompetence rate.
And it multiplies the effect, you know, the effectiveness too, because like this Amber Alert thing, I don't know if that's what it was. I don't know if that was just for California or not, but I think that's what has to do with this alert thing.
Text
messages. I think that had to do with the Amber Alert, right?
Yeah, that's what they do for like missing kids. Cause I got one the same day for like a missing kid in the area.
Yeah. And so with this Amber Alert, again, this is the government, and we covered this before because when they passed this Amber Alert thing, it was right after a kid went, you know, got kidnapped, and it was like this big story. And so then there had to be a reaction to it. And so the government kind of ramped legislation where it's like, okay, well, we're going to put in this alert system where everybody can be alerted if the government so decides in the moment's notice. And it goes on TV, it goes on the radio, it goes to your phone, you know, you get a phone call or whatever. And I can't remember exactly what it was, but of course, with that legislation, which was about saving kids, they also rammed through a bunch of other shit, which I'm pretty sure it had to do with surveillance and this other shit. but, you know, now they can kind of send out these alerts, and sure, at times maybe they can be helpful, but it is kind of another one of these kind of just the government stepping further into your privacy and getting direct access to your phone. Who's to say that they can't just shut your phone down? I believe, you know, they can.
They can do that. The Amber Alert thing is just like the typical liberal, like technocratic, like mommy state fix. You know what I mean? You're right. It's a reaction. It's just, well, we have to do something. And of course, that like mommy state mentality is always rammed through with something that's more horrible. That's what the Patriot Act was like, it was billed as like a liberal thing. Like, we will protect you, you know?
Exactly, and that's kind of like how most of these things are done nowadays.
Right, Democrats would bill spying on you as like the nanny state protecting you, and that's exactly what they do with like Amber Alerts and stuff, or anything. Democrats supported charter schools. Any type of neoliberal reform is usually an awful thing that they bill as being something that's better for you. So,
yeah, exactly. I want to kind of keep on this North Korea thing, and then we'll kind of transition into China because I think this stuff is all related.
Yeah.
So this missile thing, obviously in Hawaii, if there's like an incoming missile, let's say that it actually happened, it would obviously be the most likely candidate would be, oh, North Korea fired a missile, but like, you know, maybe we shot it down or whatever, and we saved you guys, but now we have to go start a war with North Korea, basically, is, you know, what could, something that could happen, you know, possibly. Now, on the North Korean front, there seemed to be a thaw actually going on right now. North and South Korea have actually been having some talks, and they've apparently been relatively, you know, friendly talks, and they've been kind of, you know, being able to cut a couple of deals.
They've been fairly productive. They're looking at like a joint hockey team, some wild card North Korean athletes and stuff. So, which is more than they've had in a while. So,
yeah, and they're going to allow the North Koreans to participate in the Olympics and stuff. And so, this is actually as crazy as it sounds. You know, you think like, oh shit, you know, all this shit with North Korea, but like, North and South having talks and just agreeing on something as simple as the Olympics. This is a big kind of nice, good step to help us start de-escalating and prevent some really stupid American-led, you know, military aggression against North Korea if they can kind of negotiate better with the South. Now, of course, I think a lot of what North Korea has been doing recently with the missile testing, the nuclear testing, and all this stuff has been to prove to the world that, hey, you know, we're not going to get... You're not going to just walk all over us. We've got the ability to retaliate, and we will if we're pushed back into a corner. And by doing that, I feel like that's given them a lot of more leverage at the negotiating table, and that's why now we're starting to see North and South talk, and they're starting to get along. That's the way I've kind of seen it. Jim, what do you think is going on over there?
I think definitely... Everyone knows that you're not prying those weapons away from North Korea, at least not right now. South Korea talking to them is, you know, that's been the plan of Moon Jae-in since he ran for the presidency. As you know, it's been under a conservative for like, what, 20-some years? And at that point, you know, the Liberal Party, they're not really that liberal, but the Liberal Party took over and... you know, Moon Jae-in wants to do more with speaking to North Korea, but he's been restricted even by sanctions from his ally, you know, the U.S. They continue to sanction North Korea to the point where it's almost impossible for Moon to talk to North Korea. So he's making the best of a bad situation and doing all that he can, you know. I don't think they're going to give up the missiles. I don't know what you're going to do about that, but... despite what Trump says, you can't really launch an attack. You can, but you're never going to have a friend in the West Pacific Ocean ever again.
Yeah, and look, I mean, the U.S. has already fought that war. Like,
yeah,
the U.S. already fought that, and you know that's why the lines are drawn where they're at now, because there was the U.S. couldn't win. The U.S. lost. And to me, it's pretty clear that China's made it pretty clear. If somebody unilaterally attacks North Korea unprovoked, then China will step in on North Korea's side. Now, if the opposite were to take place, and if North Korea preemptively attacked, let's say, South Korea, Japan, or shot at a U.S. ship or something, China's made it clear, look, we won't step in. We'll let them get their... repercussions or whatever. But looking historically back at the Korean War between the U.S. and Korea, the U.S. already went and fought over there, and then when they got up close to China, they got pushed all the way back to where the line's at now, and that's where this was drawn. So it just... The U.S. talking about, oh, we're going to do this and we're going to do that and all this shit to Korea. I mean, first of all, it wouldn't work. Second of all, it'd be really fucking stupid. And third of all, it'd just cause a bunch more problems than it would solve, basically.
But that's why, I mean, that's why Trump tries to lay the blame at China's feet. This is a man who's really good at looking for someone to pass the buck on. Look at what he just did this weekend, where he basically put the Iran deal on Europe. and he does the same with North Korea, where he knows he can't really do anything. He knows his options are limited. He looks for someone to dump the blame on. But the problem is, if you dump the blame on China, what are you going to do when they don't come through? You can't really punish them. I don't understand what his aim is. I don't understand what he thinks he can do, because I know the war is not really a possibility. I think China banks on that, too. I think they don't think it's very likely, or there may be a coalition to save North Korea if Trump does it wrong, for all we know.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, North Korea is like a... North Korea, I mean, I don't know the extent. Korea and China have always had this really strange relationship. It dates back thousands of years. And if you look at some, you know, Chinese history, you'll see that there are times in history where China tried to kind of invade Korea and make it part of its, you know, dynasty or part of its, you know, empire, you know, thousands of years ago, and it was never really fully something that could be done. It was just one of those where they try to invade them, there's a stalemate, and then they say, okay, well, you guys are just kind of under our sphere of influence, and, you know, that's it. The only time it actually happened was, like, under the Mongolians, when the Mongolians kind of took over that whole region, and then, you know, they just couldn't finish off Japan. But, China and Korea have always had this relationship where China isn't fully in control of, or, you know, doesn't have Korea as a full-on puppet state, but it just kind of lies within its sphere of influence, and they don't bother each other, they trade with each other, they share information with each other and stuff like that. And I honestly believe that's kind of where we're still at. You know, we're still at this point where there's just so many differences politically, ideologically, maybe between North Korea and China, that although they are their, you know, China is North Korea's closest ally, they don't see quite eye to eye on everything, and so there's always a little bit of distrust and, you know, paranoia between the groups, and, you know, that's how it's been for a long.
I believe that, and I also believe that if you think about the way they are, what if you think of South Korea, what do you think of? You think of a U.S. military presence. What would be preferred? At least we understand, you know, you and I both understand what Kim is up to, what he looks to hold on to with his weapons and things like that. China understands that too. And if you think about it, what would they rather have there than a state with a man leading it who they at least have good reason to suspect is a rational actor, or they have a U.S. military presence up on their border, not to mention a refugee crisis or whatever? I think they're much more comfortable with the DPRK just existing there. They understand how it's operating to some more than anybody else. You know, China definitely understands how the DPRK operates more than the USA does. So I think that they have that same relationship still, where it's just, look, you guys are way better than a bunch of U.S. Army troops sitting at the border and a bunch of refugees crossing into this area.
Yeah, and, you know, China made that clear during the Korean War, and that's why they intervened and pushed the U.S. back down to the, what is it, 38th parallel, they call it.
Yeah.
Because for that reason, China didn't want the U.S. right up on its border. It wanted a little buffer to keep, you know, to keep any spillover from any conflict away from its borders, so it didn't cause something internal. And I think you make a great point. You know, China obviously doesn't see Kim Jong-un as like, oh, this amazing guy that we totally have a great relationship with. But
no.
They're like, well, you know, it's not ideal, but it's better than having the U.S. right up on our shit. And, you know, being able to invade us at any time. So it's a good buffer, basically.
It's important to remember the situation where that was made, too, was at that time, South Korea was like a military dictatorship, which was basically just occupied by the U.S. So it was even worse when they pushed them back down to where the DMZ is today, because it was like, that was a horrible government that kept power in South Korea until, the 1980s?
Yeah, yeah, and also the war was just really brutal, too. I mean, that's something also to not forget. The war was absolutely brutal.
Yeah, I've written on it a couple of times, and just everything was, you know, there was, what, two modern buildings left standing in Pyongyang, millions of civilians killed.
Yeah, and you can't do that kind of stuff to a country and then expect them to want to be have friendly relations with you only a couple generations later.
That's how the anti-imperialist countries are, though. With, you know, you have North Korea, and think of Iran, where the protesters, even when the protesters in Iran don't like the regime, they hear, you know, they hear that the neocons are pledging their support, and they tell them to stay the fuck out of it. North Korea, I think, it would have the same attitude if it came down to it.
Yeah, for sure, man. I mean, these guys are, you know, like in Iran recently, you know, I think part of the contingent, and this happened, I mean, every country is going to have protests. Every fucking country. Because at one point or another, the governments fail the people, and there's going to be protests everywhere. Now, if it's a strategic country, and, you know, one country has an interest in seeing a different government in power, well, then, you know, these guys are going to want to step in, and they're going to be suspected of stepping in. And the U.S. has had a long history of doing that kind of stuff.
You know, a prime example was Mike Pence's trip to Latin America, where he met with, like, Peru. And he met in Peru and, like, Colombia and stuff like that. And he proposed, like, oh, possible military action on Venezuela. And that was when he had to cut his trip short, because they all remembered, like, what U.S. military intervention in Latin America does.
Yeah.
They basically told him, like, get going, dude.
Yeah. The world's getting wise, dude. And that, you know, yeah, what I want to talk about here. Because, look, as we speak, just over the past few weeks, there's been a lot of action as in regards to the power shifting back to the East. And mainly what we're talking about is the growing economic and diplomatic power of China, which, of course, is a major player in Korea. It's becoming a player in all the hotspots around the world. And that's what I want to talk about tonight. Firstly, the latest flippening of Pakistan over towards away from I don't want to say that Pakistan was in the U.S. sphere of influence, but they definitely, there was a you know, we had them under some kind of
they were listed as an ally. I mean, they were an ally.
We had them under some kind of, you know, leverage, but now it's been over the last just couple of weeks, it's become pretty clear that Pakistan is saying, you know what, we're done dealing with the United States and you guys' bullshit, and instead we're going to start working with China. So, Jim, I mean, I'm sure you've been on top of this subject, and we've talked about it a little bit on the show. What do you make of this whole thing with the Pakistan switching its allegiances from the U.S. to China?
You know, they haven't fully gone over. They still maintain some defense agreements with the U.S. as of now, but that's... They really walk a fine line balancing, you know, their clandestine assets and the stability of their government. So that's kind of just necessary for their own survival, is to keep some U.S. agreements in place. But the switch for, you know, using the yuan for cross-border trade with China, canceling some defense agreements and looking like they're going to go with China for new defense agreements and intelligence sharing, a big part of it has been... for Pakistan, anyway, has been India, who is obviously, you know, their regional rival. Both of these countries have nuclear weapons. Pakistan's are beefed up by China, who obviously has to compete with India as the other power in the region. But Pakistan has watched the U.S. play a dangerous game, and now you have Israel also courting Modi in India. You have a lot of unsavory characters lining up with India, and that's how Trump wants to access Afghanistan now. Pakistan's in a rough spot, and they've been kind of kicked around for a long time, so I understand why they would switch. But at the same time, a lot of people seem to be switching, and I think one major mistake that, like you said, it seems like the Chinese couldn't have asked for more with Trump. I think one major mistake to point out was, and it wasn't a good deal, but Trump's canceling of the TPP really kind of started all this.
Yeah, you know, look, I've been plenty critical of the TPP because it was kind of one of these big corporatist kind of
Oh, it was trash. It was a global,
total, gift to huge ass companies or whatever to go in.
It was on par with the WTO or anything like that. It was bigger, really.
Yeah, it was just a huge bailout for companies. But, and this is the big, this is the caveat here. And we actually were talking about this a long time ago when Obama was still trying to ram the TPP through and all this. I referred to it as an economic Great Wall around China.
Yeah.
Whereas basically the U.S. was trying to not isolate, but solidify enough economic ties and trade deals between countries surrounding China or nearby China in the region where they could basically get leverage. The way I saw it is the TPP was a way to leverage our demand for, products. And say, hey, China, well, if you don't want to play ball, we're going to manufacture shit in Indonesia instead, or we're going to manufacture in the Philippines instead, or something like this.
Right. It just integrated everyone into the U.S. supply system, everyone around China.
Exactly. And so it was kind of a economic buffer zone that was going to give us leverage against China. And when Trump scrapped the TPP, nobody really like, on one hand, it's like awesome. Like, he's kind of like, all right, dude, China, Trump actually did something right. He ended the TPP.
Yeah, I didn't care.
The other hand, I remember just thinking like, holy shit, dude, China is loving this right now.
But at the same time, China is looking at like a much more long-term investment because 60% of the countries China is taking on with Belt and Road are considered junk status by like Western, like the IMF and Western banks and stuff like that. So China is taking on a risk that the U.S. wouldn't take on. But that was the whole thing, that the U.S.'s plan was to just basically, like you said, give a corporate bailout to lock out China and treat more countries like shit. It was going to lower wages again in, the Pacific Rim and everything.
Yeah, and so, with the TPP out of the way, and with Trump kind of shifting, if not indirect policies, because he hasn't really done much on policy, but at least even just in rhetoric has kind of pushed the rest of the world out of the further out of the US sphere of influence. Now all these countries in Europe, of course everybody in NATO, most of the UN, they still find themselves within the US bubble. But they under Trump, a bunch of these countries have been pushed a little bit further out towards the margins.
I want to say real quick, he did make some policy decisions when it came to China. They were more like indecision, but they were decisions. You remember the that border standoff with India that went on for 2 months or whatever?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, all that Trump did during that standoff between two giant nuclear powers was the State Department issued like a paragraph-long statement. When China pushed Vietnam for drilling rights in the South China Sea, Trump, Vietnam, it's a touchy relationship with the U.S., but Trump didn't say shit. Mr. Tough on China didn't say anything and just kind of let them take what Vietnam claimed as territorial waters. He's made huge, non-decisions when it comes to Asia.
Yeah, that's interesting. And he's made his stand in North Korea where, nothing's happened.
No. No, he's banking on a partner that's way smarter than him, dude.
Yeah. Where expansion isn't happening is over on the Korean Peninsula because that's where the edge of Asia, and the only other person on the outside of that is Japan. And so Japan is already fully developed. Japan isn't really a place where if you're setting up a new empire, you're not going to say, hey, Japan, you want to join our burgeoning, movement to industrialize all of us, developing nations. Japan's right. Fuck off. We already got our shit together. So making for the U.S. to be making its Asian stand over there in North Korea, that's I swear it's the dumbest thing I've ever seen geopolitically. It's a miscalculation.
No, China's going the other way.
Exactly. And China is now China's like, okay, well, we're going to keep you guys distracted with this North Korea thing. And we're just going to get everybody to the west of us to fall under our sphere of influence.
Trump keeps waiting for them to do something on North Korea, and they can literally it's like the Saudis saying they're going to do something about terrorism. You can just humor the dude while you do whatever you really want to do. You know, they haven't done anything on North Korea, but he still, like, oh, Xi is my best friend. I know Xi likes me. You know, this guy's, like, lost somewhere else while they make these, like, genius moves. And I like I said, anyone who's a partner with this dude just knows how to take advantage of him.
And, like, I mean, look. I'm sure Trump has some pretty damn smart advisors and stuff.
Oh, absolutely.
But let's face it, dude. Xi is, like, 100 times smarter geopolitically than Donald Trump is. I mean, the guy is just a silent, you know, just he gets shit done, like, ridiculously without being out there in the world stage, like, oh, I'm doing this and I'm doing that. It's just, like, silently executing a huge new infrastructure project that's connecting a lot of, like, the developing world, which happens to be where a lot of the resources and a lot of the labor is coming from right now. Where the U.S. is over there, like I said, on the Korean Peninsula, where there's really nothing to be gained, and U.S. is, like, out there, and they're, and then, you know, we're just losing battles in Syria and in Iraq. Maybe not as much as in Iraq, but we definitely lost the handle on Syria, where the U.S. tried to make its, you know, stand geopolitically against Russia, and so. The U.S. is losing the West. I mean, and China is just advancing its sphere westward, and the U.S. is receding and it's pulling back. It's focusing on points that shouldn't be focused on.
And I think it seems funny to me that, like, China's dominance in Africa seemed to shock so many people because they weren't paying attention to this entire continent. And all of a sudden you have China is they're the number one job creator in Africa all of a sudden. And nobody even told you, like, this was approaching.
Yeah. So this is going to be a major front. And the U.S. already has a military presence. Now, there hasn't been very much good work done from a economic standpoint. You know, a lot of Africa is still suffering from recovering from a colonial structure of, you know, colonial society structure. And a lot of those countries are still trying to work their way out of all the fucked up things that happened.
Not only that, I mean, just post-colonial Cold War, too, was such an awful period of, like, U.S. interference and CIA operations and things like that. Even post-colonial was such a horrible, you know, it was obviously, it's like Latin America. It was treated like such shit.
Yeah. It was treated like a shithole, really.
Yeah.
And so now there's some competing interests going on in Asia, where China has become, you know, a huge player. And in fact, the U.S. and China now have military bases in the same country. I'm trying to remember.
They're about 2 miles apart.
Where was that? Nigeria, right?
Djibouti.
Okay.
Is that in Nigeria?
I think that's the city in Nigeria.
I forget, dude. There's so many countries in fucking Africa.
Yeah.
It's hard to keep.
Yeah, so now that China and the U.S. have military bases in the same country, I mean, how's this going to play out?
You know, I don't know. They seem to be doing okay right now. I think China wants it for their own power projection moves. They're not like the CIA or anything like that, you know? In fact, in Zimbabwe, like, CNN and the Washington Post and stuff accused China of interfering in the coup in Zimbabwe by not interfering. They accused them of being behind the coup in Zimbabwe by not stopping it. So, I mean, China doesn't really have, like, an interference. Like, if you look at China over the last year, what have they done? They've built, like, their own domestic aircraft carriers and their own military equipment. They're looking to project power, not really colonize things like the U.S. looks to do. I don't think you'll see China running giant, you know, clandestine anti-terror operations across Africa like the U.S. does.
Yeah, and look, I want to get your input on this. China has never done that, actually.
No.
China has always been one of the strongest countries in the world. Like, it's literally always, it always has been, right? But, I mean, China has its own internal disputes between the dynasties in the past. They've had civil wars time and time again, like, a lot of them. And, of course, you got the thing with the the areas that have somewhat of a tension with the central, you know, Chinese government. You got Tibet, yeah, and, you know,
territorial,
you got
disputes all over the place, man.
But other than those things, I don't really, I can't really give a historical context of China actually being an imperialist power. I mean, of course, we're not including the Mongolians here. But China itself, other than kind of just Chinese disputes, and like I said, they have, a long time ago, they tried to fight North Korea and invade, they tried to invade Korea before, but it never, it just never worked out. So China has always kind of been a country on its own, but not one that would invade other countries. And so as the power, as the balance of power does shift, and I think in the next 20 years, it's going to be apparent that the U.S. is no longer the most powerful country in the world, but China actually is, and maybe the U.S. is a distant second place. When China has that power, do you think that they're going to be do you think they're going to be an empire, or do you think they're going to be something different?
I think they'll be something different, because I think that look at, like, if you look at their economic model develops totally, their way of working, you know, it develops so totally different from the U.S. Look at the U.S.'s economy is so based on imperialism and war, and meanwhile China's building an economy on a totally different philosophy. Why would they begin by building it like this when, if they were going to be like the U.S., realistically, they could just invade their neighbors. They could have their own, you know, French and Indian War or whatever they want to call it, you know. If they were going to be like that, I get a feeling that they would be like that. That's why I think people like dealing with them. They aren't going to come push around. They kind of have that, at least to an extent. And obviously, you know, they are a state, and I'll give you that, and they have their own interests at the end of the day. But they do seem to have a genuine interest in making long-term investment, and they seem to realize that a neoliberal war economy won't last. It's not sustainable. And the U.S. is proof. They have proof that that economic model doesn't work. There's plenty of proof that the Western empire model doesn't work.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And, you know, the U.S. is kind of a, is like a hybrid of what the British used to do, and the U.S. kind of said, well, you know, if we kind of just privatize the empire for the most part and only use the armies to go knock out governments, we can kind of get away from the, you know, the old pitfalls of empire was having too many occupying armies spreading too thin around the world, trying to occupy all these countries.
Right.
And stuff like that.
Well, and now they've spread themselves thin financially. They've collapsed their own financial systems from trying to, you know, initiate economic hits on people.
Yeah, exactly. And so, of course, every superpower learns from the other, and the U.S. learned from the British model and the, you know, the Dutch East Indies Company, and that's kind of like, that's like a miniature version of our empire now, or, you know.
Yeah.
That's kind of called the whole thing off of. And China, I think we can look historically at what they've done in the past. And you know, China has been, if you look back at the old Silk Road days and all that stuff, it's always been not about conquering land, but developing
its commerce.
Economic ties with other peoples.
Yeah.
And it seems like they're continuing that today. And also just learning from what the U.S. had done, the mistakes the U.S. made, learning from that. Now, of course, this is when I talk about China, for the most part, I talk about the external workings of China, the international China on the international stage. Right? And looking at them from that aspect, they actually seem more benevolent than the United States. Now, that's nothing to say of what actually goes on within China, where they've got hell of surveillance and censorship, and there's plenty of authoritarian shit going on. But if you look at what they do outside, do they project their authoritarianism outside? They really don't. They actually don't.
No, I won't comment on their internal matters, but how they treat Africa and stuff like that, how they treat those countries is they they seem much more genuine when they say, like, some X country is a partner. It's a partner. And no, they don't launch troops there. You know what I mean? They don't launch troops. They don't immediately move in like Blackwater to protect all their sites and things like that. And look at the countries, you know, like I said, 60% of the countries in Belt and Road are considered, are the countries that Trump was calling shitholes last week. You know?
Yep.
So they're willing to move in and work with people that the U.S. is abandoned anyway and would treat like shit, and loans them money and lets like the Gates Foundation in to set up monopolies and steal from them.
It's an economic hitman style where they just they find some rich politicians, put them in a bunch of debt, and then put them under their thumb. You know, that's what they do.
It's China, or you have like Monsanto and like Bayer and stuff like that coming to your country to try and help you rebuild. Which option is really better here? And one won't try and handpick your politicians, you know?
Yeah.
I think China definitely has a philosophy of, well, whoever picks up the phone in the morning and is willing to do business with us, that's who we'll talk to.
Exactly. I mean, that's the thing is, if you really take a more human look at it, instead of trying to manipulate the politicians, you just let it boil down to the human factor, man. The people need to eat. People are going to make things happen to make the economy happen. And China doesn't have to pick the politicians. They just know that whoever has the power is going to want to work with them.
That's what I mean about Zimbabwe when like CNN said like, oh, China was behind the coup because they didn't do anything. It's not that they were behind it. It's just that they called up the next day and said, hey, you know, who's the new boss? And can we talk to him? It's not like that guy's going to say, like, no, we don't want Chinese money anymore.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, here's the thing. This is the thing that's so funny, not funny, but just ironic, about the U.S. complaining about Russian electioneering in the United States. Is that the U.S. has been going around to, like, all these countries all around the world electioneering, dude. Always electioneering.
Oh, yeah.
In our own allies. Like, even in countries who are, like, you know, these are, like, close. Like, even, like, let's say in the U.K., you know, the U.S. goes in and shows favoritism in the election system and tries to get certain parties in power.
You want the best example I saw in the last week and a half was during the Iran protests, David Frum, who's constantly complaining about Russia and saying that, you know, the Atlantic is constantly on the Russiagate bullshit. David Frum's outlet posted a bunch of stuff that, like, sanctions weren't letting social media properly subvert Iranian protests.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's what they, you know, they openly say that they want to do that shit to other countries, and then they expect you to give a shit about this Russia stuff.
Yeah, and then it's like, oh my God, the Russians posted a few Facebook ads, and, you know, it's ridiculous. It's
right, and these are the people who've made, like, whole fake social networks in Cuba and stuff like that, you know.
Yeah.
Like, I trust them to tell me who's really messing with stuff.
Do as I say, not as I do, right?
Right, and look at, you know, what, the DNI report just blamed everything on RT, and they've turned up, what, some Black Lives Matter Facebook ads?
Yeah, dude, and like a few $100,000 for the Facebook ads. It's
yeah,
multi-billion-dollar election.
Yeah. I don't think so.
If that kind of shit can disrupt your election, you got a fucking problem, dude.
Dude, if Russia, like, Russia, this country that's fucking starving for money, has projected too much power, is in a fucking on the back foot, is constantly pissed off, if those people manage to, like, outfox the fucking biggest intelligence industrial complex in the world, like, you guys should really check your shit.
Seriously, man. Hey, Jim, thanks for joining me, man. You guys go check out his website, geopoliticsalert.com.
All right, man, nice talking to you.
Thank you all for tuning in. You know, we'll be back Wednesday with some better news coming from the foreign policy front. We'll see what's going on. We'll get some updates. Happy Martin Luther King Day, everybody. Talk. Go through the stereo.
stereo. Go and let it blow, blow through the stereo. I'ma let them know, no, through the stereo. Yo, here we go, go.